Amazing. Rightio. Okay. So hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Somewhat unconventional in comparison to previous week's editions because we've got, unsurprisingly, a bit of a virtual element to it. So let me introduce our special guest. He's joining us via video call. Emma Newman, CRO for EMEA for PubMatic. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you very much for having me in strange circumstances.
But quite nice to see the artwork that you've got on your walls in the background there.
Yes, it's my little gallery wall. Trying not to push the chair back too quickly because then I
knock all the pictures off the shelf.
On my head, yeah.
Don't do that. And, of course, next to me, we're breaching social distancing convention 100%. Here, Lindsay, quite cozily next to me in the ExchangeWise studio, Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content. How's it going there, Lindsay?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Battles in today.
Was there traffic?
I'm in Walthamstow, actually. I walked down my street to the station and there were people everywhere, cars everywhere, buses everywhere. I was like, what the hell's going on? Do you guys not read the news or listen to the news?
I walked past Sainsbury's at 6:30 this morning and there were a load of old age pensioners queuing to get their, you know, their allotted hour that they could go into Sainsbury's by themselves.
But it was so cute
because they were all having the 2 meters between each other. So they were chatting away.
But with a good bit of distance between them, that's quite sweet.
They've taken it very seriously.
Yeah, good. As they should. You know, and I was saying to Lindsay, I had a similar sort of experience on my journey until we weren't traveling during peak hour. There was quite a few people around, but I'm thinking a lot of those are probably key workers.
Yeah.
Because there's still a lot of people that need to get out there and go to work and go to their place of work. They can't do it remotely. Yeah, absolutely. Keeping things ticking over.
I'm sorry. I'm loving that Emma's making hand signals to clear family members that are interrupting her in the background.
My teenage son just came in and he's like, and he's back again.
What do you want? What do you want, teenage son?
Go out is what he wants to do. Right. See you later. Have fun.
Bye now. Have fun. Stay, keep distance.
Right, he's gone now. Just got a dog to deal with, but we're good.
Brilliant. Okay, well, let's crack on with discussion of news stories of the week. As I'd noted when I was sharing around some ideas of what we might talk about with the two of you, obviously news stories are pretty much firmly focused on the world of coronavirus, and we'll get to that. But I did manage to also dig out a couple of things that seem very, you know, specifically relevant to our industry. The first is an article that the French antitrust regulator have fined for the second time actually this year, Apple, a whopping great big fine of $1.2 billion USD on this occasion to do with what they outline as unfair contractual obligations that they've imposed upon wholesalers. So this was with respect to coming to a sort of an agreement amongst one or two wholesalers in the French market that they wouldn't compete with one another, but then Apple having a stranglehold on those wholesalers, sort of shoehorning them into contractual obligations that meant that they had to accept certain charges and certain terms and conditions, which not only sort of meant that others weren't able to compete, but also meant that Apple were able to effectively control those contractual arrangements and control the amount of sort of profit and revenue that those wholesalers were getting. So a massive $1.2 billion USD fine. It's worth noting that the French Competition Authority were also successful in fining Apple earlier on in the year for a much smaller, modest $25 million USD. And that was to do with deliberately slowing operating systems on old iPhone handsets, which I think is a case that we're probably all fairly familiar with. So I thought this was interesting because we talk a lot about, you know, what antitrust regulators are doing in the ad tech industry in general. We talk a lot about what is happening to Apple's business. You know, they were until very recently mostly focused on the sale of hardware. I think their business is shifting somewhat from that. So I guess what I'm interested in from the two of you is perspectives on this as an antitrust topic of conversation and an antitrust conversation, and also perspectives on Apple's business and whether this will actually, change the ways in which they operate their business in any regard. Emma, what's your thoughts on that?
I think there's two questions there, right? So I think the first question is around the fine. The $1.2 billion is a lot in anyone's world. And definitely. I think, look, if you've done something wrong, then regardless of who you are, you know, you should expect to, you know, have to pay some kind of price for that if you've broken any kind of rule or law, right? I don't think anybody should be immune from that. I think the interesting thing right now is the timing of the fine. You know, receiving a fine this large, even for Apple, during a time of such economic turbulence is probably not something that any business owner is going to be happy about. I think that, you know, if we, in the current environment that we find ourselves in, tech companies have a sustainable structure that means that they can support, you know, the high employment rate that they have, right? These large tech companies employ a lot of people.
Yep.
And because it's a tech infrastructure, although Apple obviously does have retail as well, you know, it means that they can support their employees with flexible working hours and working from home and, you know, all of those kinds of things. So I'm not saying that Apple shouldn't be fined or anyone else that, you know, does something they shouldn't do. I am just interested on whether the timing is right. Because do organizations, even, you know, the French antitrust or the competition authority, do they really want to start penalizing very large employers at this particularly critical time when it comes to, you know, trying to maintain employment and people's standards of living and, you know, trying to maintain a degree of economic stability?
Well, it's interesting, actually. That's a good point that you raise. I mean, I suspect that in part the timing was somewhat kind of out of their hands. I imagine with it being a sort of a sort of a legal and bureaucratic process that the case may well have been brought forward quite some time ago. Once it goes through the wheels of the various bureaucratic organisations that it needs to, and the various legal stages that it needs to, a decision is made and a fine is applied, and maybe that just all coalesced to happen around one of the perhaps biggest crises that the world has ever seen. Yeah, so it's perhaps somewhat sort of out of their hands to some respect.
I don't think they've timed it on purpose to land at this particular moment. It's just unfortunate.
Especially because it would have been very difficult to predict exactly how this particular crisis we find ourselves in is going to unfold. But the interesting point that you make, I think, connects to the fact that, of course, Apple announced closure of all of its stores in the US and also in other countries.
Everywhere except China.
That's right.
Until it's reopened Chinese stores, which is testament to how well China's doing.
Indeed.
But yeah, close everywhere else.
And so that makes me wonder, to what extent the employees they've got in those stores, I think they might have even said in their press release that they'll all be paid. But we know that, you know, employee rights and employee contracts vary from country to country. But I think the point you make is a really interesting one, which is they are a massive employer and they're a company that's got deep enough pockets to weather any kind of financial storm, at least for the short term. Mm. So you're right. You want them to be. In fact, I imagine it's very welcome good news that they've started opening their stores again in China, not least of all because that will mean everybody, you know, a whole bunch of people are getting to go back to work and so forth. But that also the wheels of, the economy start to sort of roll on over there, perhaps.
It gives us all hope, doesn't it, really, to some extent, that, you know, definitely, there is that, you know, all things being equal, I guess, that, you know, this, some you know, a country like China that really took a very large hit with what's going on at the moment is coming out the other side. And organisations like Apple who are reopening their stores, you know, I think that's a good indicator in a degree of confidence that, you know, maybe they have come out of the work. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a scientist and, you know, I'm no expert in this at all. But I'm looking at that as going, okay, there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, totally. Lindsay, what's your point of view on this particular story?
Well, I think, I mean, to agree with Emma, it's unfortunate timing, and it's a massive fine. It's the largest antitrust fine that France have ever levied on anybody. And it seems high. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming that the amount of the fine does fit the crime. And if you are trying to create an entire industry, kind of make it completely anti-competitive in France, then that is huge in the handset market. So it makes a lot of sense. But it's crazy that $1.2 billion, particularly versus the last fine that they levied was something like $25 million.
It's a massive difference, right?
Different.
Yeah.
But yeah, Apple are a huge company. They're a very cash rich company too. They have a lot of money, but in these unprecedented times, as we keep saying, like, it's their money needs to go to other things and not go to having to not even pay fines, but even fight the fines that they are getting, because that in itself will cost them God knows how many millions in legal bills. But talking of their stores being closed everywhere except China, I was in Stratford Westfield in London at the weekend, and walked past the Apple store before it was due to open, obviously knowing that it wouldn't open, and all the staff were in there having a big team meeting. Walked past again a bit later when it was open, and all the staff are standing outside their closed doors. We take the safety of our staff as number one priority, so we're going to put them out at the front of the store among the hordes of people walking past, so they can stand there and say, "I'm sorry, we're closed. I'm sorry, we're closed. I'm sorry, we're closed. Yeah, no, we're just sorry. We are closed." There were 20 of them outside the doors of the Apple store. It was hilarious. I had to laugh. It was ridiculous.
That's an experiment in social distancing all on its own, right there. Crazy times. What about any perspective either of you have got on this with respect to antitrust? So that's a topic we've been talking about a lot, which is, to what extent will competition authorities and antitrust regulators really look to take some of these big global tech firms to task? Appreciating that possibly quite everything that we're talking about under this topic is a little bit to be confirmed, because we don't know what the coming sort of, you know, even 3 to 6 months looks like in terms of global financial outlook, and therefore what even, you know, government organisations will be focusing on. But we've talked a lot about those competition authorities and those regulators being very, particularly in Europe, being very serious about tackling these big major tech companies. Do you think this is an indication of where the French antitrust authorities are willing to go? You know, issue a fine like, you know, the size that nobody's ever seen before?
Are the French trying to fund their coronavirus budget? Because they're very, very fine active at the moment. They're very trigger happy on the old fine. You've got Slew with Critio.
Literally anything that moves.
Exactly.
I think antitrust is a very serious matter. I think it was only a matter of time before, you know, the industry that we all work in came under the spotlight. I mean, don't forget, other industries have been, held accountable to these kinds of stringent rules for a very, very long time. So, you know, it was a matter of time before, you know, it sort of hit the tech world. I think there's a couple of concerns I have, which is, you know, so we talk about the, you know, the 1.2 billion fine that Apple have just been landed with. I guess my gut feel is, does that actually match the crime? Because I don't really know. I don't know, you know, how much money they made out of doing what they were accused of doing. Or is it more of a, we're just going to slap the biggest amount possible, knowing that we're not even going to get a fraction of that, but we're going to get the headlines that we need. And maybe it's a scaremongering kind of thing. I mean, I don't know, obviously not being party to that kind of information, but you sometimes wonder how much of this is real, right? Is 1.2 billion really what they think they're going to get? Or are they just going to do the biggest amount possible, get the headlines, send the message that they are serious, and then see what happens from that? I also do think that sometimes we need to make sure that the antitrust organisations and the regulators really fully understand the industry that we're in, and what we will do and the part that we will play, and all of the things that we're already doing to be... you know, to be in line with what's required of us. And I think that's also something that, you know, slightly keeps me awake, which is people are judging, you know, we're being judged by organizations and people who may not necessarily really understand everything that we do.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really interesting point. One, are they doing this mostly to make an example of what they're capable of doing, knowing perhaps that they won't necessarily get that 1.2 billion in the door, but they want to actually, you know, flex their muscles? And two, to what extent do they realise and appreciate that they need to sort of know a lot more about, for example, the advertising technology industry before they're able to make a sort of judgments that are actually going to impact the way the industry matures and progresses and moves forward. I mean, certainly that's been a big conversation that we've been having here on the MadTech podcast and at ATS events over the last 12 months, the degree to which, you know, privacy regulators understand the industry and therefore understand the recommendations and the potential rulings that they're bringing forward and the impact that those are having on the industry. Now, of course, this doesn't relate to, you know, this relates to the sale of hardware. It's a completely different sort of field, but I think the two are connected, as you rightly suggest.
But I also think then that, you know, there is an onus on us as an industry, because it is our industry and we are the experts, right? So there is an onus on us as well. And I think that we need to be, you know, we need to go out and be prepared to educate people about exactly what it is that we do and how we do it. I know that we've been having lots of conversations, you know, with the ICO and people like that, just to, you know, to help them understand. I think the IAB does a pretty good job of that as well. I think they've actually had a webcast this morning just about what they were doing in that area. So I do think the onus is also on us. We can't sit here and go, we're not going to tell you anything, and then expect everybody to know what's going on. You know, it has to be a joint thing. And I think we all need to step up and play our part.
Absolutely. We have to be much better at articulating the value of the way in which the industry is constructed, what the end value to the user is. And as we've said many times before, you know, we also need to perhaps re-engineer the ways in which we're designing solutions within the industry to make them much more sort of having the sort of end user somewhere very central to what it is that's being established, you know, appreciating what that experience is going to be like for people that are navigating their way around the internet.
And I think that's a really interesting point. And I will let Lindsay speak in a minute. but I think that's a really interesting point. And I was having this conversation, I was doing a panel somewhere else, and actually Kieran was in the audience, so he heard what I said, which is, we talk a lot about, you know, the advertiser and the agency and the DSP and the SSP and the DMP and everything else and the publisher. And then, sorry, but who's talking about the consumer?
Mm.
You know, exactly. We seem to have gone so far down one across over this side, I'm jesting, over to the right, and we've actually forgotten that the group of people that we should be most concerned about really is the consumer, because unless you have an engaged consumer that trusts the media and trusts, you know, the technology partners that are in this space, then we don't actually have an industry.
Totally, 100%. Lindsay?
Yeah, I agree with that. I always lament about the fact that the consumer is always left out of this conversation. And I often ask that when I'm moderating panels, kind of, what about the consumer and all this? And you're absolutely right that in talking about all these things, it's we're talking about the impact of our industry and the future of our industry. But the consumer ultimately will have the final say, and the consumer does. And we saw that with the rise of ad blockers. It's ultimately down to what the consumer can cope with and can understand. And there's still that element of lack of education that, I mean, Emma, you mentioned it earlier, kind of these people that are doling out these fines, how much about what we do they actually understand? Very, very little. But the same is said with the consumer as well. So there's still a massive lack of understanding. These people that are trying to get their heads around what we do, and we're referring to them as idiots for not getting it. But of course, they're not. It's just very complicated, and we like to overcomplicate things on purpose. I think that there's going to be, but I think there's going to be more of it to come. And we're already looking at the US are looking at some of the smaller acquisitions that companies like Apple and Google and Facebook have been making. They obviously have to investigate the larger acquisitions, but the smaller ones have gone unnoticed. When they start looking at those ones, Apple will be under fire there as well. So I think that this is a huge fine, but Apple will see a lot more of it.
Yeah.
And will be fighting in the courts in probably most countries, if not this year, then next year.
Yeah. It will be really interesting, I think, to see where that sort of activity goes. Okay, I'm going to move us on to discussion of the next news story for the week. I wanted to talk about a Business Insider report, Business Insider article that references a report from Magna Global. A Business Insider report. I want this is a proper tongue twister. I want everyone to have a go at it. Business Insider report focusing on Magna Global's research study into advertising spend and the impact that the cancellation of sporting events is having on that advertising spend. So we partly started to talk about this topic in the podcast last week. We were talking about what the potential cancellation of the Olympics, what impact that would have on advertisers' budgets and the world of advertising. This is a, and of course that was at the time mostly speculation. This is obviously much more grounded in reality because in the intervening 7 days, there's been enormous number of cancellations of a whole host of events, including a lot of sporting events and sporting activities. And so this is a study into what budgets, what advertisers, sorry, are doing with those budgets in the event that these, in the reality rather that these events are being cancelled. And it's also a bit of a discussion on how important those sporting events are to broadcasters. So not only do they bring a lot of advertising dollars in, but they bring an enormous amount of viewers in as well. Mm. Now, the reports found that, yes, of course, those advertising dollars aren't going to be spent in that particular area, but that doesn't mean that there isn't an opportunity for those advertising dollars to be spent elsewhere within those verticals. So we're talking about television and other broadcasting sort of forums and channels, but that actually, where you're seeing a reduction in viewer numbers because there's no sporting events to bring those viewers to those channels, there is arguably an increase in viewer numbers looking at other content, specifically news and entertainment related content. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot more time being spent certainly glued to the news at the moment. And then secondly, a lot more time being spent at home than perhaps would have happened before. And we also discussed this last week within connection to an increase in the numbers of people gaming online, which is something that was certainly reported in China during the really fierce kind of lockdown phase back in January and February. So, interested in your perspective on what cancellation of sporting events does for broadcasters and where the potential opportunities are here, not just for advertisers but also for other, streaming, video-related content, even if it's not associated with sporting activity. What's your point of view, Emma?
Well, I think the first thing I'd like to say is it's enormous. I think live sport is enormously important to broadcasters. Channels have built an entire business around that. If you think about Sky Sports, that's all it is, right? So, and they've built very successful businesses. And if you think about the impact on football with the money that, the broadcasters bring into the game because it's so important to them to secure the rights to show the games or, to show Wimbledon, which is I've got tickets for Wimbledon this year. So I'm really hoping that goes.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Because they're like rocking horse.
Oh, absolutely. Little pieces of gold dust, those.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. But anyway, I digress. That's my personal selfish perspective. but yes, I think so. I think first and foremost, live sport is incredibly important to broadcasters. I think that's also, and it's incredibly important to bring an audience to that broadcaster, not just for the sport, but, to get them familiar with that broadcaster and for the wider content that they have. And I think a really good example of that is when you start to see, the non-linear TV broadcasters like Amazon, for example, who are investing in things like the US Open.
Yeah.
Now, that brings a whole potentially different audience onto the Amazon platform that perhaps wouldn't have engaged with Amazon content. They may obviously know Amazon as a shopping destination. But by, going after the US Open, and I think they also had some Premiership games as well, it brings a whole new audience into that platform that perhaps wouldn't be engaged. So I think that the power of sport to bring an audience to a broadcaster, I think, is unarguable.
Yep.
What do I think the impact is on cancer? I mean, obviously there's going to be an impact to the broadcasters, both in terms of audience numbers, but that's why I think it's really important that it's not just broadcasters. Broadcasters don't just have a sport offering. They're actually bringing people in to look at their other content. So, they may have engaged that audience and that audience may go and look at other content that they have. But yes, of course, there'll be an impact to broadcasters in audience numbers and audience engagement. And we all know that, audience numbers and audience engagement is what brings advertising dollars to a publisher. So if you don't have that audience, then it's not unreasonable to assume that you're going to be impacted by a drop of advertising dollars. But I don't think it's all doom and gloom because, TV linear or not, video, audio, digital, the internet, those are all, and gaming actually, because my son is a gamer, so all live gaming, Those are all things that's where the audience is going to go. When you're stuck indoors, you know, that's where you're going to be. I really think that the biggest people that are going to suffer are people like cinema, out of home, you know, those kinds of media, because they just don't have the audiences that they were going to have. And we know that.
And principally because the audiences are being kept away from them, right? Yeah. This is not to do with lack of demand or lack of interest anything like that. It's just to do with the machinations of quite literally being restricted. But yeah, I mean, I think you raise a good point. To me, it seems that there is still a lot of opportunity for advertisers, but just in different formats and in different channels, or channels they might have already been present, but around content they weren't anticipating that they were going to necessarily be investing in. Lindsay? Go on, Emma.
I was going to say, but I also think we need to think, I don't think we can just do a broad brush, you know, all advertisers are going to be negatively impacted. I mean, there will be different verticals of advertisers that will be impacted more heavily than others. You know, so obviously travel and entertainment, you know, they'll probably take a hit for a while. And so I think you'll see those budgets drop regardless of what channel that they're advertising on. But conversely, there will be other advertisers that, you know, may see this as an opportunity. I don't mean that in a sort of a bloodthirsty negative way, but, you know, from adversity, you do get opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. And also, I think that it's likely, again, it's really that we're caught currently in this phase of not really knowing what the immediate future is going to hold. So we don't know for how long we're going to be living as a society like this. But there's an argument to suggest that once we move beyond this phase, which we will, you know, things will go on. We will move beyond this particular phase, that, you know, when things have truly settled down later on towards the end of the year, that those industries that are taking a hit might actually get quite a bounce, quite a rebound, because people will be so, you know, anxious to get out and to do things and to, you know, not just get back to the plans they already had, but it might even be inspiring a lot of people to, you know, get a little bit more adventurous than they would have otherwise, because they've, you know, this is a whole, you know, part of society that they've been kept away from for a number of months.
Yeah, I think you start to realise what you take for granted, right? I mean, I am literally, this sounds like a very massive first world problem, but I'm sort of sitting here going, well, we're probably not going to go on holiday this year.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, certainly not over the summer months.
Yeah.
You know, so the minute that travel ban's lifted, I'm booking something as you know, as soon as I possibly can. So I just think that regardless of the impact, the situation I think we find ourselves in now is going to, and it's like the conversation you and I were having, you know, earlier, which is, you know, the way we work will change. I think that the way how advertisers view their marketing mix moving forward, regardless, will potentially change, because business as usual, wherever that may not be an option. And this creates opportunity for all channels and partners to really prove their value to the ecosystem, which I think will be interesting.
Definitely. Lindsay?
Yeah, well, I think where there's muck, there's brass, as they say. I feel like for the broadcasters, there's obviously huge revenue comes from them through sports broadcasting, and that's going to be a huge loss to them. But the outside impact of that, if you're not a sports-only channel, if you're part of a kind of broader network, is that the fact that you do still have that audience, even more so than normal, that are stuck at home and doing nothing and are trying to find content to consume, that the TV rates, whether they're linear or OTT, should technically go through the roof. There's no reason why they can't. And obviously upfronts are being delayed, so the kind of the inventory out there would be a really interesting mix. And in the UK, we've got the challenge of in maybe a month's time, a lot of our big soap operas are not going to be able to air because they've had to shut them down, shut filming down due to coronavirus.
Yep.
So you've got all the kind of the big sponsors of things like Coronation Street on ITV and Hollyoaks on Channel 4. They'll have to find somewhere else because they won't have that audience anymore. Kind of, what will the big TV slots be if these popular live shows, these popular audience led shows like Saturday Night Takeaway with Anton Deck? I'm naming all the crappy ITV shows at the moment.
Watch a lot of these shows, I think.
The advertisers will have to find new areas of getting in front of their audience. We've talked about new digital opportunities. Gaming. So if you can't, we talked last week about gaming and the opportunity of esports. If you can't obviously be a sponsor and advertise in kind of big esports arenas because they're being shut down as well, things like Twitch are massive opportunities to kind of get in front of an audience that's looking for new areas to amuse themselves. There's so many articles out there about, well, if you're stuck at home, these are the next big shows to watch. These are the shows that advertisers should be looking at. How can I get in front of that audience? Whether it's through product placement, whether it's through advertising, whether it's kind of, you know, there are so many opportunities out there. And of course, it has to be outside of Netflix. But, you know, Emma, you mentioned Amazon earlier, kind of there's opportunity there for advertisers to get in front of. Hulu and Roku are doing a lot as well in the US. There's a lot that could be said, you know, from the sports aspect.
Yeah, now TV do quite a bit as well, don't they?
They do, exactly, because they're part of the Sky group. So there's tons of opportunities on Sky and Now TV. Yeah. And I think that it'll just be a new way for advertisers to be able to find a new audience that they probably have quite stuck in their ways. It's forced them to think a bit differently. Speaking to some brands, there are some brands out there that where they're seeing store closures, they're having to now focus their efforts on advertising to try to increase their online sales. So they're now looking at brand new efforts in the marketing mix to look at things they've never looked at before because they're trying to drive online sales, so opportunity there. But we also have to think about the fact that there are some advertisers, certainly in certain verticals like travel, that will not be advertising. Right. And that's going to affect all of the media owners out there, if they're particularly big budget travel advertisers and advertisers out there that can't advertise, but also if they can't advertise and end up potentially going bankrupt, then it will affect the entire supply chain. So everybody in our industry will be impacted by that. So the media agencies, the DSPs, the SSPs will have an impact. So I think the publishers and the broadcasters will, and everybody in between will need to help find ways of diversifying revenue streams for their existing customers to try and mitigate the impact that those advertisers that do cut budgets will have on them. And it's not just about the content out there, it's about the advertisers they're trying to deal with as well.
Absolutely. Well, there's a couple of things going on at the same time there, right? So you've got obviously the fact that there will be advertisers that just can't advertise at the moment. Like you say, there's either no point or there's just, you know, this is just literally isn't the right time for them to advertise. And then there's what might happen to those businesses. And then there's the knock-on impact of that to the rest of the supply chain, as you said. But there's also the uncertainty that's surrounding all of this because we just don't know.
No.
So we don't know. Still here as at, pardon me, date of recording, we don't know whether there's going to be a full lockdown imposed on us here in London or nationally. Well, obviously, there's lots of rumours and we're all anticipating that is going to happen. But if it does happen, how long does it happen for? If it doesn't happen, does that sort of, you know, mean that there's still a bit of movement of people? If it does happen, then how draconian will that really be? And for how long will it last? Like you said, Emma, you know, we're actually going, you know, here in the Northern Hemisphere, obviously everybody's kind of going into spring and then summer. And I think that's hugely going to impact what we would otherwise know as the holiday season. Mm-hmm. It'll be a lot of people not taking holidays, but it also, as we were chatting earlier on here this morning, might be that schools, which are just going into closure here in the UK after tomorrow's last day, right? You know, does that mean that there won't be a regular school summer break? Like, will that be brought forward to now? Like, yeah, what is that going to look like?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we were sort of hoping, and it was unrealistic, but what we had heard a while, I mean, obviously my son is off. His school actually closed a few days ago because unfortunately quite a few of the teachers were showing symptoms, although none of them were diagnosed, but they decided that they would be safe rather than sorry, which is, you know, absolutely the right thing to do. But in my head I was thinking, well, if they close now, that's fine, because we'll just basically, this will be the Easter holiday, and then in fact they'll go to school during the Easter holiday. But I don't think that's going to be possible, because I think they'll close for longer than that.
Exactly.
So, you know, will they go to school in the summer? I mean, what about the kids that have got to do their GCSEs and their A-levels? I mean, they've been told that they've been cancelled. But what does that actually, you know, I mean, I've got a friend who's got a daughter, bless her. She's got a daughter doing her GCSEs and a daughter doing her A-levels. So she's got a double whammy, and, you know, they don't know what they're going to do. So, you know, everything could change, really.
That's exactly it. And we don't quite know what we're dealing with here. Mm. So as you rightly point out, Lindsay, there's going to be an impact on everyone within the supply chain, but we still don't really know exactly what, you know, it's still really difficult to predict what that impact will be. About the only two things that we know for sure is that in some way, shape or form, this will all be temporary. Will it be temporary for 1 or 2 months, or will it be temporary for 6 months? We're not sure. Mm. And, you know, and of course, there's lots of talk of what the government will do to support businesses that are potentially failing, which no doubt must extend to some of those travel businesses that we're thinking of, possibly even commercial airlines, who knows. But will that be enough? And what will be the knock-on impact when those businesses, you know, when the sort of dust settles for those businesses where they've either contracted significantly, therefore their budgets have reduced, therefore they've made some staff redundant, or they've gone out of business altogether. And then what's the knock-on impact of that? There's just still so many questions. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Okay. Moving on to the third story that I wanted to chat with you guys about, a good article in AdExchanger earlier on this week from Dennis Buckheim at IAB Tech Lab, outlining a little bit more detail about Project REARC, which is interesting because they announced this, I'm going to say at least a month ago, maybe a little longer than that, and we were all interested to know exactly what it was going to be focusing on. We understood the principle of it, which was to try to provide some kinds of uniform solution and I suppose somewhat an approach for the ad tech industry to move beyond the world of third-party cookie targeting, but we weren't quite sure what that was going to look like. So this article, Q&A with Dennis and one of the AdExchanger editors, writers, was really helpful in kind of getting down to brass tacks as to what that was going to be. So they've explicitly stated they're not going to be looking to develop their own identity solution. They already have an interest in an existing identity solution, DigiTrust, which they acquired some time ago, but that still relies on third-party cookies. So that's going to still be in operation until such time as third-party cookies can't be used or can't be utilized for targeting purposes. But they've actually stated that they've no intention of developing a independent standalone identity solution. Instead, they have joined with the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, to work on an identity project. We've spoken a bit on this podcast and also at our first ATS event of the year back in February in Stockholm about how it feels as an industry like an identity solution is kind of nicely placed to be developed by somebody that's not got a profitable interest in it, interested in everyone's views on that. And they've also stated explicitly that what they're going to be working on rather than a standalone identity solution is providing the foundational basis for any of that work. So working on compliance, standards, the sorts of things that are you know, a core part of the IAB and the kind of things that IAB Tech Lab has been working on for quite some time anyway, in an attempt to move the industry on regarding issues of, fraud, data privacy, those sorts of things. So they've really come out the gate here saying very clearly, We're not developing our own identity solution, but we want to be the organization that's going to, create that foundational layer of compliance and standards that we want the industry to adhere to. And they're also calling on others, privacy organizations and browser owners, to participate, not just in the W3C project working on an identity solution, but also in that conversation together with the IAB Tech Lab about what those compliance and standards and regulations ought to look like from an industry point of view. So what's your opinion on this, Emma?
So I think there's a couple of things really. I think that look, as the digital ad ecosystem looks for, you know, consumer-friendly audience addressability solutions, you know, the rapid expansion of ID choices, and it is rapid, is creating growing complexity. And frankly, in this uncertain world, and I don't mean coronavirus, I mean just, you know, the ecosystem that we all love, I assume, buyers and publishers, I think, need less confusion and not more. So, you know, I mean, the irony is it was, you know, at one point we were talking about a single ID. Well, I'm not sure that that's totally practical, but we seem to have gone to almost the other extreme now. And I think that, you know, the challenges of providing identity across the open web are really just a too big an issue for one side of the industry, let alone one company to solve. I do think it's something that everyone needs to come together to agree to build the right solution. Do I think it needs to be one solution? I don't know. Do I think that, you know, the premise of what the IAB is trying to do around, you know, regulation and making sure that there's compliance and people are playing fairly, I think that's, you know, obviously vital. But yeah, I think it's an incredibly, incredibly complex part of, you know, what we're all trying to navigate now. I'm not sure I've actually answered your question, but
well, I was just interested in a general opinion. And I think what you're saying is, you know, the world of identity solutions has become, you know, pretty speedily complex. If we row back to, say, this time last year, we were talking about it, obviously, and there were people working on identity solutions. There was the notion that maybe there might be a single solution or one or two solutions that the industry could work to. Here we are, you know, 12 months later, and actually there's a plethora of identity solutions, which is not helping. It's certainly not helping, you know, diffuse the complexity of an industry that kind of seems to enjoy complexity. That's therefore making it harder for, you know, advertisers to be navigating their way around this. It's creating opportunity for some, but, you know, it can be in too much complexity. I think often there's an inherent disadvantage for a lot of people in that kind of environment.
Well, we've been talking about making things easier for the consumer, and I'm not sure that this makes things easier for the consumer.
No.
I also think that, you know, audience addressability has been broken for ages, really, you know, and whether the third-party cookie or the demise of the third-party cookie is 2 years away or, you know, 2 days away, you know, it doesn't really make a difference. If you think about it, how can you say that we've been doing a good job of addressability when already approximately 30% of the audience traffic is unknown because Safari and Firefox have been blocking cookies, you know, for a long time now.
Yeah.
Now, then you kind of go, well, whose problem is this, right? Is it the publisher's problem? Because obviously, you know, their revenues will fall and ad dollars then flow to the walled gardens where people did know who the users were. So I think that, you know, sometimes we sort of, you know, we sit here and we complain about the walled gardens, but then we do things like removing cookies from Safari and Firefox, and then, you know, the dollars have to go somewhere where the advertisers know who they're talking to. But I think identity affects advertisers as well, because campaigns and specifically their efficiency suffer when marketers can't target their desired audiences and then forced to turn to more, you know, competitive environments.
Absolutely. Lindsay?
Yeah, Emma, I agree with that, because I actually think that as long as we make it, keep it as complex as it has been for the past however many months and years we've been talking about this, it's not just the consumers that are getting confused by it, it's actually the advertisers too. And the advertisers need to know where they can safely put their money. And if that's not clear to them, they will continue to put their money into Google and Facebook. And as long as Safari kind of ramps up its ITP efforts, as long as Chrome does the same thing, they will see safety in doing so and just keep putting money in Google and Facebook. Let's not get started on the Facebook aspect of this, but I think that there's still a lot of confusion here. Reading the interview with Dennis, big fan of Dennis, extremely smart guy, and I think that the way he's explained it makes a lot more sense than Project Rearc first did. I think he's come out and admitted that actually the IAB, we didn't really approach it in the right way in terms of how we were communicating it. And I think that what he's saying now is it makes a lot more sense. So there were big questions about what DigiTrust would mean. Obviously, DigiTrust set up by Jordan Mitchell, like he's admitted that will have an expiration date. That is not going to be the future of what our identity solution, cookieless identity solution, will look like, because it still relies on the third-party cookie. And I think that him talking about W3C and the role that it'll be W3C and its members that will ultimately come up with something that is effective, not just for the advertising industry, but for the entire internet. And I think that that's going to be a big job. But as long as everyone's part of it and the right spokespeople and the right representatives are a part of W3C, I think we'll get somewhere. But what interests me, a comment Dennis made in that article, was the fact that nothing that Safari is putting out there fills him with any confidence. But what he does have confidence in is what Chrome are doing. So I think that it's one thing, and we say this about the IABs and things in the world anyway, and all these different industry bodies that are out there. It's one thing being part of it. It's another thing actually being an active part of it. And you can sit there and listen, and you can sit there and interject and say when something's not good. But if you aren't putting forward viable solutions, which according to him, Safari aren't really, then should you really deserve to be part of it in the first place? And I think that might come into question. The problem with these industry bodies and these consortia is that people will start to come to loggerheads. And this is such a big, like, life-defining moment in the future of the internet, that everybody, whether they're part of W3C or not, need to be coming together and putting together practical solutions. And it kind of sounds like they're not.
It's interesting. Well,
I think that's really important. I think you've kind of really sort of hit the nail on the head there. I think, look, whatever happens, right, what's really crucial is that whichever identity solution emerges victorious, and I'm not suggesting that one will on its own emerge victorious, but I'm sure, like in every industry, you'll start with hundreds, and then, you know, we'll realize it's too complex, and then we'll start to narrow it down. Whichever one ends up being part of that smaller consolidated group, you know, we need to make, and it's back to the consumer, we need to make sure that that solution puts the consumers first and is safe for everyone to use, and will stand that, and actually really importantly, will stand the test of time. You know, it needs to be future-proofed, or at least be capable of being future-proofed, because if it's going to really work, then it has to be able to be implemented across all formats. So absolutely. Not just the desktop, but also, you know, what does the mobile industry look like? What does CTV and OTT look like? You know, you've got digital out of home. What does that look like? You've got digital audio. What does that look like? So if it's going to be a true identity solution, then, you know, it needs to be omnichannel. And I don't think we're going to get to that, back to your point, Lindsay, we're not going to get to that if we just expect one organization or one company, you know, to come up with that solution, because it requires input, it requires, you know, collaboration amongst the industry to come up with something that works for everyone, including the consumer.
And I think it's interesting because Dennis made that point in the interview, saying there's quite a chasm at the moment between the sort of the privacy community, the browser community, and perhaps a bit more of an alignment between those two, and then the advertising community on the other end. Mm. And that actually we need to get to a place where everybody is involved in the conversation and understands one another's perspectives. So at the moment we have a scenario where the notion of privacy and the way that the browsers have approached that has been very much, you know, not quite antagonistic, but it's been very much from the point of view of trying to put the user first, which is absolutely the right thing to do, but assuming that advertising was this thing that was entirely unwanted, which, excuse me, arguably you could say that it is to a large extent because we haven't done advertising well. Now, sort of the undercurrent of everything we've just talked about today is that actually the advertising industry and the advertising technology industry is at a particular point in time where we perhaps have the ability to make advertising a much better experience, particularly if we do that from the point of view of how the user is, you know, experiencing that and consuming that. And I think Dennis's point is, if we could bring all of these sections of the community together, and if we could develop an identity solution that works across the board and accept that advertising has got a place, that actually it can be an experience that users don't despise, and that, you know, this can also adhere to something that is data privacy compliant, something that enables browsers to operate in a way that protects their users' data, then we might actually get to a solution. And I suppose further to what you said at the start, Emma, I'm not sure that there is one universal solution, but I think this conversation around trying to find one is really critical.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
Well said, Rachel.
Yeah, that was easy then.
Well said.
All right, we've solved that. Well done. Well done, us.
Okay, well, let's move on to the second part of the, since we have solved the big, you know, sort of conundrum of the industry, let's move on to the second part of the podcast. Talk a little bit more about what you're up to at PubMatic, Emma. Excuse me. I hasten to add, these are asthmatic symptoms.
I'd say we don't have a COVID-19.
Watching Lindsay just move further and further.
Yeah,
I know.
I'll
yeah,
she's not, over here now.
I mean, Lindsay doesn't enjoy sitting this close to people at the best of times. I'm making
she
it much
not.
Harder for her today. Yeah, right. So back to PubMatic.
I think that a lot of what we're doing right now ties into, you know, all of these things that we've been talking about. And particularly, you know, things like how do we help premium publishers, you know, compete against the walled gardens, especially, you know, as things like identity become more prevalent. And as we've already discussed, you know, if advertisers can't reach the audience and engage the audience that they want on the premium publishers, they'll go to the places where they know they can, which right now are the walled gardens. And I think, you know, that's a challenge for both publishers and buyers, because I think buyers want diversity as well and don't want to be, you know, reliant on spending 90% of their ad dollars, you know, on two or three big publishers. So I think one of the things that we've started to see a resurgence in, actually, and more conversation around, are premium publisher consortia. And I think one of the reasons why this has started to come to the forefront is that, you know, I mean, we've been talking about this for a long time, and there have been some consortia that have worked. There have been some consortia that have been less successful. And I think there are a multitude of reasons why that may be. I often think the biggest one is that, you know, the whole point of a consortia is to provide, you know, targeted audiences at scale, which does require a degree of trust between the publishers. You're going to have to share perhaps more than you would normally. And they're so used to competing against each other that that feels like, you know, an anomaly to them. And I think, you know, I actually think that Ozone have done a good job. You've got the big four news groups in the UK working collaboratively together. And I think that's a good footprint. So I think, you know, we're starting to see that come back, because I think premium publishers have finally realized that if they're going to compete against the walled gardens in delivering a desirable audience to buyers at scale, you know, this is one of the ways that they're going to do that. But again, in order to do that, they need to A, understand who their audience is, where they are, and most importantly, make them easy to find for buyers, especially as we move into this world without cookies. So, you know, that's a key thing that we're thinking about, which is how do we help publishers and buyers navigate this kind of new landscape? And there's lots of work that we've been doing around supporting ID solutions. We've just recently launched an identity hub, and this is not going to be a sales pitch, I can assure you. But, you know, we've talked about the complexity of the number of ID solutions out there. Well, how do we help publishers manage that number? I mean, they may not want to work with all of them, but there's a good chance that they may want to work with more than one. So, you know, how do we help them to manage that so that they can then make sure that their audience is addressable for buyers? And, you know, how do we help them also leverage the data that they have? Because, you know, obviously the thing that the walled gardens have is an enormous amount of data, because the users are all registered and logged in. So, you know, you've got this plethora of first party data. But premium publishers also have a lot of first party data. So how do we better help them, you know, monetize that data for the benefit of the consumer, the publisher, and the buyer at the end of the day? And, you know, we've just recently launched a product called Audience Encore, which unlocks publisher data in the open exchange, which allows them to sell their inventory and data in the same auction. Now, I think this is important because, A, pubs benefit because they can sell both the data and the inventory. Brands benefit because they get access to valuable new segments outside of the walled gardens. You know, the way that we've designed the product means that we can eliminate data leakage, which obviously makes it much more secure. And valuable way to trade for data owners. And it enables data sellers to sell first, second, and third party data with fewer hops. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, we've been focusing on, both to support publishers, but also to support the buyers as well.
And what are you finding? So sort of in those conversations and in, I suppose, helping some of your publisher clients navigate their ways around the industry landscape as it currently is, how are you finding they're approaching that? Are some publishers finding this a really easy sort of, I don't even want to say transition, but because I'm imagining for some publishers, they've had logged in data for quite some time. Yeah. So they've been wanting to execute that data in particular ways. They've perhaps, you know, known that they've, that or understood the value of maybe buying in a consortia environment. So are you finding that these conversations are easy to have? Are there some publishers that are that much more advanced and are maybe even, you know, coming to you with sort of things that they want to do and creative solutions that they want you to work together with them on?
I think it's a mix. I think we're finding that the conversations are a lot easier to have now than they were perhaps 18 months ago. Because there is obviously a lot of chatter and concern about what's happening with regards to identity and data and walled garden competition, all of those kinds of things. So I think that having those conversations or starting those conversations seem to be a lot easier. I do feel that publishers are in different stages of their thinking.
Yep.
So back to your point, that there are some publishers who do have a plethora of data and are used to having that level of data, who are perhaps being, you know, they're slightly ahead of the curve because they've got it. They've been used to working with it in some way, shape or form, you know, for a while. And they're the ones that as being slightly more creative, going, right, we've got this. We've done this to date. What else can we do? And those are really interesting conversations and have often, you know, helped us think slightly more beyond the tomorrow to what the future looks like. There are other publishers where they're, you know, they say, you know, they're going, look, we've got a valuable audience. We know we've got a valuable audience, but it's not a very large audience. So how can you help me basically extend that? And I think that's, you know, another problem that we're helping publishers to tackle. And there are other publishers who, frankly, haven't even really thought about it yet.
Okay. So very early on in that journey.
Very early on in that sort of, I guess, the thinking. But the good thing is, really, that everybody's talking about it.
Much more so than they were, say, 12 months ago, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's almost like the perfect storm because you've got, you know, the cookies going away, you've got data, you're trying to compete against the walled gardens, you've got this plethora of data, you want to make sure you're GDPR compliant because obviously that's never going to go away and we need to make sure that anything that we do is. And obviously there'll be more compliance coming in. We've seen the US adopt it in certain states as well. So, you know, that's also going to be something that we need to make sure that we, you know, we are fully aware of. So, yeah, it's a very interesting time. But what I think is what's really interesting is we're seeing a willingness now of premium publishers to work together, either under official consortia or just, you know, more loosely. And we're seeing buyers come to us and go, and ask us proactively, how can you help us to access these premium audiences at scale? And I think that's always been the biggest challenge is the audience has always been there. It's just not had the scale.
Interesting. And are you finding then that that's sort of bringing that conversation between publishers and perhaps advertisers a lot closer together then as well? Are you seeing, you know, that there is, I suppose that the lines of communication are a little closer, a little more aligned than they have been before?
Yeah, I think that I think to compete with, you know, I hate keep going back to the walled gardens, but you can't ignore the fact that they're
the dominant players, shall we call them.
Let's say that. I'm not, you know, this is not a Google and Facebook bashing exercise, but no. I think, you know, to compete with those guys, we are likely to see brands and publishers championing technologies that enable flexible and collaborative direct partnerships.
Yeah.
And I think we're definitely seeing more brands being aware of, okay, where, so I think the good thing is that brands are now asking the questions about, okay, what am I buying, both in terms of a brand safety perspective, but also in terms of an audience perspective. You're seeing publishers being much more willing to, you know, to think about, okay, how do I make my audience more accessible in a brand safe environment? And you're seeing the guys in between, both the SSPs, the DSPs and the agencies becoming much more collaborative and almost, well, not the stack isn't going away, but kind of compressing the stack a little bit and enabling slightly more direct conversations, both conversation, but also technology conversations. So how the tech works with each other.
That's a good thing, right? Lindsay, what's your opinion?
I would say it's a very good thing. I mean, I think that if nothing else, this is proving that we can actually work together. And Emma, you talked earlier about there were publishers, premium publishers willing to work together either in official consortia or just kind of in their own kind of
unofficial partnerships. Yeah.
But that's been the biggest issue we've had. We look at the failings of consortia in the past, Pangaea being a great example, is that too many egos have been getting in the way. And one great thing that Ozone have had has been that it is a separate entity with one person that's not actually got any skin in the game with one particular publisher or another. And that's meant that Ozone's been really successful off the bat with this project. But actually, if premium publishers are now putting their egos aside, putting differences aside and saying the way we work together is to oh god, there's just notifications going off
so
everywhere.
Many, I know, I was just gonna say, sounds, I have to apologize to listeners today. We've got notifications, we've got Emma's teenage son. We haven't heard the dog yet though, Emma. I'm a bit disappointed by that. Yeah.
I think I can hear people hammering as well.
I was
well.
About to say, I think I can hear the construction work going on out the front.
I'm having my drive relayed as well.
Just brilliant. This is what it's like next few months. Say, though.
Get used to it. Get used to it.
Like on telly, right?
Yeah. But yeah, I agree. I think that people are realizing that the future is that how we go against this. And again, as Emma said, it's not a Google and Facebook bashing session, but how do we
dealing with the realities of the
how
industry,
how do we actually become, how do we viably compete with them? And that's what it is. It's not about saying, oh, they're so big and they're doing amazing and they're doing all this illegally or whatever. How do we actually allow ourselves to have a piece of that pie?
Yep. And would you say
what's really interesting is that consortia have traditionally been desktop. You know, they've traditionally been the traditional desktop, you know, premium publishers. And yep. What we're starting to see now actually is that video and CTV publishers are starting to get in on the act as well, because they also realize that, you know, that they need to work more collaboratively together to again compete, you know, in a world where Amazon's investing in content and, you know, you've got the Netflix of the, I mean, Netflix doesn't have advertising at the moment, but who's to say that won't change at some point. So we're also starting to see, you know, more publishers looking to trade their CTV and their video and their in-app inventory actually programmatically. But again, how do they do that and get that scale? And then how do they look at their tech partners? Because they'll start to think about, okay, we might need slightly different tech partners to those we've had in the past. How do they then look at those partners and evaluate the ones that, you know, will be able to, you know, provide the supply chain and the support that this requires? We harped back on this earlier on, which is, you know, viewer video consumption habits are growing increasingly fragmented. And with the efficiency that driving consolidation and buyers are looking to look at fewer platforms and to better control cross-platform reach, you know, a lot of these publishers who have been traditional desktop publishers are moving into the video space. So consortia won't be just about desktop anymore. I think it's going to be omni-channel.
Yeah, very interesting.
Which is really interesting.
Can provide them with an omni-channel solution.
Yeah, for sure. And that's interesting because it's sort of mirroring what we're seeing anyway with programmatic as a buying tool, right? Like it's not just retargeting. Exactly. It's not just retargeting anymore. It's much broader than that. And you're starting to see the industry and technology solutions form themselves around those opportunities. So, you know, I think it's providing us with a really sort of interesting platform from which to see how the industry is going to grow or sort of morph, change, mature over the next kind of 12 to 18 months. Global, unforeseen crisis, pandemic crisis aside, notwithstanding.
Who knows what could happen in the next hour? So.
But aside from the things we can't predict, it feels like a very interesting time to be in ad tech.
And I think that's, you know, when you say, what are we focusing on? I mean, I think it's the change in the consumer. It's the change in the buying habits. It's the change that publishers are having to go through. I mean, our job really is to try and support all of that. So we're very much, you know, heavily focused on making sure that we've got an identity solution that works for both sides. We've got, you know, the capability to enable people to, you know, monetize their data in a safe environment that works for both sides. It's about making sure that there's a, you know, we have true omni-channel capabilities because, you know, publishers are expanding into different formats almost, it feels like, on a daily basis. And that's, you know, that's really where we're spending our time and efforts.
And just back on the identity solution for a minute, when you're saying making sure you've got an identity solution that's working for both sides, are you working with partners on that? What's your approach?
Well, so, you know, our identity solution is something that is basically a plug-in. It's built on pre-bid and it enables publishers, I'm simplifying, really my benefit, to be honest. I kind of describe it as a wrapper for identity solutions. So, and it's built on pre-bid. You can run it through the UI. I mean, the identity solution, which ones they use is down to the publisher. So the contract is between the publisher and the provider.
Got it.
And that's their decision. Our job is really to help provide the technology that enables them to manage whatever route they decide to go down.
Yeah, interesting. Emma, we've run out of time. So thank you very much for joining us from your very nicely decorated home office / living room, and for persisting with our technology ups and downs. And I'm going to have to thank the listeners for dealing with that too, because God only knows what this audio file is going to sound like. But it was a great conversation. So I really appreciate you joining us, Emma.
I loved it. Thanks.
Not at all. And thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.